From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On this special holiday edition of FSN Reports, we delve into the dark history of the Vietnam War and the abuses carried out during the decade-long conflict by the U.S. military.
He heard his lieutenant on the radio ask what should be done with 19 civilians that they had rounded up, and the captain, a West Point train captain, said, "Kill anything that moves."
Journalist and author Nick Turse takes us through his investigation into what he exposes as the pervasive and systematic abuse by American troops against Vietnamese civilians.
They're 18, 19 years old, they're rewarded for killing, and they realize very quickly that the American command didn't much care who those bodies belonged to, as long as they were Vietnamese.
Author Nick Turse on his book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. That's our extended interview after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Dan Whitehead. An Ethiopian Airlines flight to Rome was forced to land at Geneva Airport after it was hijacked by its own co-pilot. The man, who was arrested by Swiss police on landing, was requesting asylum in Switzerland and didn't have a weapon. Our Europe correspondent Jack Parrock has the details.
An Ethiopian airline flight from Addis Ababa to Rome was forced to land at Geneva Airport after it was hijacked by its own co-pilot. The man in his early 30s is an Ethiopian citizen and was seeking asylum in Switzerland. The plane called into Geneva Airport saying it needed to refuel before circling above the city several times. Once landed, the hijacker scaled a rope out of the window of the cockpit before being arrested by Swiss police. The hijacker will appear before a Swiss judge on Monday and could face 20 years in prison for hostage taking. The 200 passengers and staff on board are unharmed. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
Ukraine's opposition has ended a more than two-month occupation of City Hall in Kiev, with the government saying an amnesty for prisoners will come into force. But despite the compromise, demonstrators are keeping up pressure for President Viktor Yanukovych to keep up what they call dictatorial powers and let them form a government without him. Yanukovych is expected to name his candidate for prime minister, with his choice deemed crucial in deciding the next steps of the country's political crisis. Our correspondent Tom Barton reports.
The prosecutor's office says it will drop charges against protesters for violations they say were committed between December the 27th and February the 2nd, a period in which at least six people were killed and hundreds of protesters and police were injured. Opposition leader Arseniy Yatsenyuk says they are watching to make sure about 2,000 criminal cases are dropped. They still want constitutional changes to reduce the powers of the president. After the resignation of the last Russian-born hardline prime minister, President Yanukovych has until the end of the month to find a replacement, but is expected to name one shortly. Tom Barton, Moscow.
The president of Venezuela has expelled three U.S. consular officials from the country, accusing them of meeting students involved in anti-government protests. It comes amid growing political tension in the country, with three protesters dying in clashes last week. Nicolas Maduro has not named the U.S. officials being expelled, but said the foreign ministry would give further details later. Despite storms easing, Britain is faced for further floods as rain continues to fall on heavily saturated ground. The Prime Minister David Cameron has described the weather, which has left three people dead, as a tragedy. Mr Cameron has chaired daily COBRA meetings to discuss the situation and has announced a £10 million fund to help businesses recover from the floods. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Six illegal gold miners have left an old South African mine amid concerns dozens more may be trapped underground. The men emerged from the mine near Johannesburg when it appeared the threat of arrest had gone. The official rescue operation was suspended on Sunday after 11 miners agreed to come out. 12 Years a Slave and space film Gravity were among the top winners at the British Film Awards. The prize for Best Film went to 12 Years a Slave, while Gravity won Best British Film. The awards were closely watched as an indicator of which films may win Oscars in a fortnight's time. Our UK correspondent Natalie Feary has this report.
Space drama Gravity scooped the most awards at the BAFTAs, including Best Director for Alfonso Cuarón, a total of six prizes. Chiwetel Ejiofor was awarded a BAFTA for his role as Solomon Northup, a free man sold into slavery in the film based on a true story, 12 Years a Slave. The British actor thanked the film's director, Steve McQueen, for his artistry and passion. Best animated film went to Frozen. Actress Kate Blanchett paid tribute to Philip Seymour Hoffman, who died earlier this month when she collected the Best Actress Award for Blue Jasmine. Natalie Feary, London.
And don't forget, you can see more stories from our reporters around the world on our reporters' blog. Just go to featurestorynews.com. Google has acquired an Israeli startup business called Slick Logan, a technology company which identifies users by sound waves. The software works by playing a uniquely generated near-silent sound through computer speakers, which is then picked up by the mobile phone app. The technology could be used as a replacement for a password. The company confirmed the news on its website, but did not release any further financial details. And that's the latest from Feature Story News, Dan Whitehead reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to this special edition of FSN Reports. The first televised conflict and a devastating defeat for the United States military. The Vietnam War would leave millions dead, wounded and traumatized. But when people think about atrocities committed during that war by American troops, the vast majority cite the My Lai massacre. However, as my guest, award-winning journalist and historian Nick Turse demonstrates, abuses by the US military against Vietnamese civilians were more widespread and devastating than previously exposed. I began by asking him why people should choose his account of the Vietnam War from such a competitive genre.
Well, you know, we have 30,000 books in print on the Vietnam War, some great military histories, diplomatic histories, combat memoirs, all these books, but not one that attempts to tell the complete story of what I came to see as the signature aspect of the conflict, Vietnamese civilian suffering. Millions of Vietnamese were killed or wounded or made refugees by deliberate U.S. policies, like the use of almost unrestrained bombing or artillery shelling across wide swaths of the countryside. But if you look at most books on the war, the civilians are almost non-existent. We don't hear about their story. And of course, you know, these were the people who experienced the war the longest and the most intimately.
What sort of level of suffering are we talking about in terms of numbers?
Well, you know, it's hard to get very good numbers. We'll never know exactly how many Vietnamese civilians died in the war, but the best estimates we have indicate that there are around 2 million civilians who were killed, and that's about using the best methods of estimation we have. That comes out to about 5.3 million civilians who were wounded during the conflict, and then using U.S. government statistics, we know that about 11 million Vietnamese were made refugees. So we're talking about suffering on an almost unimaginable scale.
What sort of reaction have you had from Vietnam veterans, both those that you've worked with and spoken to, and whose accounts have helped you put this book together, but also those who have read your work?
Well, you know, I was prepared, you know, in some ways for the worst, because I know this is you know, it's a side of the war that that a lot of Americans in general don't want to hear about. And I know there are a lot of veterans who are resistant to it. But I have to say, you know, since the book was published, I've had about 80% positive feedback from Vietnam vets. You know, there are many veterans who do write to me and say that this isn't the war as they experienced it. Their units didn't subject civilians to any kind of harms. And it's quite possible. I'm always actually heartened to hear that. And I hope I get across in the book that that I'm not saying that all U.S. soldiers did this. But I'd have to say the overwhelming number of veterans who contacted me said that they were very happy to have a book out like this, that really reflected the war as they experienced it, and were glad that even at this late date, someone was finally telling the true war as they saw it.
You had, in the book, you had a breakthrough with an archivist during your research. Can you explain to the listeners why that was such a pivotal moment?
I was a graduate student at the time, and I was working on a separate project on post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. Vietnam veterans. And I would be down in the National Archives going through hard data to match up to interviews that we had with veterans. And on one of these research trips, I just hit one dead end after another, one brick wall again and again. And I finally, after 2 weeks, I had nothing to go back to my boss with. And I went to an archivist that I worked with pretty regularly down there, and I said, look, I can't go back to my boss empty-handed. I need something, at least a lead. And he thought about it for, you know, all 5 seconds or so, and he said a couple words that ended up changing my life. He said, "Do you think that witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress?" And I said, "That's an excellent hypothesis. What do you have on war crimes?" And he told me about a collection of files called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. And within an hour, I was going through about 30 archival boxes filled with the U.S. Army's own investigations of massacres, murder, rape, torture, assault, mutilation, all these crimes investigated by Army criminal investigators. And almost all of them, the reports came from American veterans. So this is, you know, this was my introduction to the project. There were records that I could never get out of my head, and it launched the project that eventually became Kill Anything That Moves.
And when we think of abuses carried out in the Vietnam War by U.S. military personnel, we think of the My Lai massacre. But these abuses were far more broad and widespread and wide-ranging than that.
There were investigations of every U.S. division and what they also call the separate combat brigade. So basically all the major U.S. units that served in the Vietnam War were represented in this collection. So I realized quite quickly that it was a much broader story than My Lai, that this was went the length and breadth of the country over all periods of the war. And from there, these records started my journey. Then I went around the country interviewing veterans who were represented in the records and others who I found through other leads.
You traveled to Vietnam yourself because you're a young man, I should say. People can't see you, but you're a young man and you were in fact born in the same year that conflict ended.
That's right.
But you've been to Vietnam and you've spoken to the people who suffered during that period.
Yeah, I made several long-term research trips to Vietnam, and basically I would go out into the countryside and I would bring these stacks of documents with me. I would go to talk to the Vietnamese about one specific spasm of violence, something represented in the records. But very quickly I realized there was a different story to be told. What the Vietnamese would tell me about was what it was like to live for 10 years under bombs and artillery shells and helicopter gunships, and how they had to negotiate every aspect of their lives around what they call the American War. And very quickly, I realized that while my book would be punctuated by these stories of American atrocities, that there was a much larger story to be told, one that dealt with heavy firepower and what that meant for Vietnamese civilians.
And of course, the chemical aspect of warfare in Vietnam.
Sure. The use of Agent Orange was widespread. It wasn't something that I focus on a great deal in the book, but when you asked about the toll that the war took on civilians, the latest scientific studies that we have show that about 4 million Vietnamese were exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange during the war, and these have lasting effects. There are Agent Orange hotspots around the country, and it's caused suffering now for generations.
Tell us about the title of the book. I understand it was inspired by the experiences of a certain Vietnam veteran.
Yes, but the title first, this is actually a phrase, Kill Anything That Moves, that I saw in a number of records over the years. But what made the first impression on me were the records of an investigation launched after an Army medic named James Henry. He, basically went to Vietnam as a draftee, and he became a highly decorated medic. He saved a lot of American lives. And the men that he served with that I talked to said that also he showed a great deal of humanity towards Vietnamese prisoners, which was uncharacteristic for the unit. I found Jamie's records, and then I eventually went to talk to him. And Jamie told me a little bit about his experiences. He told me that his first day in the field, he realized that there was something wrong. He watched as the point man, the lead man of his patrol, detained a young girl on a trail and molested her there right in front of everyone. And he said to himself, my God, what's going on here? And over the next few months, he saw a litany of atrocities take place. A young boy who was beaten and executed for no reason. A man who was captured and held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier, basically a small tank. another old man who was used for target practice. And Jamie didn't like any of this, but when he spoke up, he was told in no uncertain terms that he'd better keep his mouth shut. And even his friends came up afterwards and said, "Look, you really better keep your mouth shut, or you're going to get shot in the back during a firefight, and no one's going to be the wiser."
So he tried to broach this while he was serving in Vietnam.
While he was serving, which was a very dangerous prospect. Not many people tried it for these very reasons. And so Jamie did keep his mouth shut, but he kept his eyes open. And that brings me back to this phrase. He was in a small hamlet. It was on February 8th, 1968, just after the 1968 Tet Offensive. They pulled into this hamlet, and he took a break, and he was listening over the radio, just smoking a cigarette, and he heard his lieutenant on the radio ask what should be done with 19 civilians that they had rounded up, and the captain, who was the ranking officer on the scene, a West Point train captain at that, said, "You know the orders that came down from higher headquarters this morning. Kill anything that moves." And the lieutenant rang off, and Jamie immediately hopped up and ran over to where the captain was to see if he could get that order changed. And what happened was he arrived just at the time when these 19 civilians had been amassed, and the Americans around them opened fire. So he watched all of them killed right there in front of his eyes. And he told me that 30 seconds after that, he vowed that he would make that massacre known, that he would expose it, and he worked very hard to do so. But that phrase, that kill anything that moves, it really stuck in my head, and as I read the records, I saw it. I saw that's what men in Jamie's unit remembered, and then I started to notice this phrase come up again and again in other records, other cases where there had been massacres or killing of civilians, and you mentioned earlier the My Lai massacre. And that's the order that those men were given the day before they were told to.
Can you remind us of the My Lai massacre? What happened?
Yeah, this also took place in 1968, March 16th, so just about a month after the massacre that Jamie Henry witnessed, but a totally different unit in a different province. And, these troops were under the command of Lieutenant Kelly and a Captain Ernest Medina. And it was Medina who told the men that they would get some payback. They'd been taking losses from booby traps. They hadn't met the enemy face to face in battle, and he said that the next day they would be dropped into what they call the hot LZ, where they would be under enemy fire basically as they landed in their helicopters, and they would have a chance to get some revenge. And he told them, as the men remembered it, to kill everything that moved. They landed the next day, and they found a village that was had no military personnel in it, just women, children, and old men. They were just finishing up breakfast, but they followed his orders to a T. They killed people in small groups, ones and twos, throughout the village. They raped women. They mutilated the bodies. And then a tremendous number of Vietnamese were herded into a drainage ditch, and the men around opened fire. And for the day, more than 500 civilians were killed during that operation, during just about 3 hours.
Going back to something you said earlier about, the title of the book, Kill Anything That Moves, the body count became an issue in Vietnam, didn't it? Because it was almost, you can define success by the numbers of dead. Is that an order that sort of filtered down into the U.S. Military in Vietnam and saw them kill not just enemy combatants but non-combatants?
That's right. The body count was central to the American project in Vietnam, basically because they were fighting a counterinsurgency war, in a country that was basically their ally. So they weren't fighting in an enemy country to take territory. This wasn't take a hill and hold it. They were basically looking for a metric to show that they were winning, and they settled on the body count. The idea was that basically you could kill your way to victory. Eventually, the Vietnamese revolutionaries would look at their credits and debits, and see they were losing, so many men that they couldn't field a force, and they would sue for peace. Of course, the Vietnamese saw this as a nationalist struggle. They saw it as a continuation of their war against the French, which the Americans had bankrolled during the 1950s. So, you know, they didn't see the war that way. They weren't going to capitulate. And, these U.S. troops on the ground were pressed for bodies. This is what, Jamie's unit saw and Medina's unit at My Lai. I mean, these men were under a tremendous amount of pressure to produce enemy kills, is basically what it was called. And, if they didn't produce a body count, that meant you stayed out in the field longer. You were courting exhaustion and a greater chance of being killed or wounded. And they were pressed hard, and they were given incentives if they produced bodies. 3 days rest at a beach at Vung Tau, the U.S. resort, or extra beer or better food. And a lot of the guys that I talked to said that this really, it messed with their value system, that they, they're 18, 19 years old, and they're rewarded for killing. And they realized very quickly that the American command didn't much care who those bodies belonged to. There was an informal dictum in Vietnam: if it's dead in Vietnamese, it's VC. VC being Viet Cong, the enemy guerrillas. And most of the men said that this is how it was in their unit, that nobody cared who the bodies were as long as they were Vietnamese.
We have American troops who've left Iraq, but we still have American military in Afghanistan, although there were plans for a drawdown in 2014. It's the most unpopular war, polls suggest, the most unpopular war in American history. Why should people still be paying attention to your work, to your book?
Well, I think there's a great deal of relevance in this. While there are a lot of dissimilarities between the American wars in Vietnam and Afghanistan, I think that we still see in Afghanistan a counterinsurgency war where the Americans have never been quite certain who the enemy is. That it's always been difficult to root out the enemy. I think the Americans thought when they went in that this would be a pretty cut and dry campaign, and originally it was. They had great success of ousting the Taliban, but after that, when you begin an occupation of a country, it tends to grate on the civilian population, and I think this is what we've seen in Afghanistan, and certainly what we saw in Vietnam, that the Taliban was reduced to nothing, and they were never very popular in Afghanistan. People were happy to see them go. But we see that, over the last 12 years, the Americans haven't been able to, oust the last remnants of Taliban, and actually they've grown over the years. That the civilian, and you can't have an insurgency, exist, let alone gain ground, without having support from the civilian population, which means that the Americans have alienated the civilians. Now, while I don't see that the same scale of killing in Afghanistan, I think U.S. firepower is used in radically different ways than it was in Vietnam. I still have looked at the civilian casualty issue there, and the Americans have over the years killed significant numbers of civilians, and this was the problem in Vietnam. They alienated the civilian population. That breeds more support for the insurgency, which generally leads the American military to act in harsher terms towards civilians. And this is just, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in a lot of ways, and one that's very difficult to extricate yourself from.
Nearly 40 years after the end of the Vietnam War, do you think had these the atrocities committed during that conflict by the U.S., been highlighted earlier, given more media attention and more scrutiny on the Hill, do you think we would have situations like Abu Ghraib, for example, the torture that was carried out there?
Well, I think if these crimes had been exposed back during the war, it would have gone a long way to perhaps reforming military culture. And I'm not the only one that feels that way. These records that I mentioned, the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group, I should have noted that they were put together by a secret Pentagon task force. And I talked to the men who served on that task force, who were generals and colonels during the Vietnam War. And one of them that I spoke with, his name was General John Johns. He lives in the D.C. area. And he told me at the time he was all for keeping these records secret. He thought it was in the best interest of the U.S. military. But when I went and interviewed him, the Iraq War was still going on, and we were, of course, in Afghanistan at the time. He told me that he thought that was a real mistake, that if those records had become public at the time, if the military had had to grapple with the very tough questions about what they'd done to the Vietnamese civilians, that maybe, there have always been regulations in place, but that there would have been better enforcement and that there would have been better training, and that the military would have known what to look out for. So he really thought that that this was a major failure on his part, and if these records had become public, it could have saved America a lot of strife.
Yeah. In 1971, John Kerry, who are now U.S. Secretary of State, he delivered an important speech to the U.S. Senate.
They told the stories of times that they had personally raped, cut off ears, cut off heads, cut off limbs, blown up bodies, randomly shot at civilians, and generally ravaged the countryside of South Vietnam.
John Kerry before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1971. How much of an impact did that testimony have, and did it in any way shape your work?
Kerry went before the Senate as a representative of the group Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And basically he laid out as we just heard in very graphic detail, what members of Vietnam Veterans Against the War had seen and done in Vietnam. He was speaking about, he was recounting what he had heard just weeks before at something called the Winter Soldier Investigation, where 100 veterans from all the major combat units in Vietnam had gotten together in Detroit, Michigan, and talked about what they had seen and done during their tours of duty. And he came back and he relayed that to the Senate. It was something that made a big impression on me and actually factored into the first article I ever wrote from those War Crimes Working Group records. Because Kerry, as we heard, listed out all those different types of atrocities. And when I looked at the records, I saw them all represented there, not from the men actually that he had talked to, but different men who served in different units at different times. I looked at that testimony and then looked at the sworn statements that I had in the documents. It drove home to me just how ubiquitous atrocity had been in Vietnam.
I saw your book described as the following: Kill Anything That Moves offers neither argument nor a new narrative. It simply aims to make violence against civilians the essence of what we should think of when we say the Vietnam War. Do you agree with that assessment of your work?
Well, those are very strident terms, but I do think that, as I came to understand the war, I came to believe that Vietnamese civilian suffering was the key aspect of this war. I think this really and truly was the essence of the war for most people who lived it.
Journalist Nick Terse, the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
My guest, Nick Terse, discussing his book Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. And tomorrow, FSN Reports returns to its usual format with our coverage of events here in the US and from our bureaus worldwide. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.